Hello, everyone. Happy Sunday evening. It's good to see you all. We are here for the teaching from the Seven Steps to Awakening. And the last, I don't know how many teachings, I mean many teachings have been focusing on quotes from Nisargadatta Maharaj. But tonight we begin Step 3 quotes by a different teacher. The Supreme Yoga, also known as Yoga Vasistha. So, I guess I will be playing a song. I thought that maybe I wouldn't, but I guess that I will because I feel to do so. So the song that's jumping out at me is by Yiruma. That's just an instrumental. And it's called River Flows in You. And we'll just sit and be still while we listen to this song in order to prepare for the Seven Steps teaching. All right. Wonderful. So let me get the link for you. I think I usually do that, don't I? So this is a link that I am providing. The link goes to my journal. And I will be reading first from the book, The Seven Steps to Awakening, maybe sharing a little bit. And then I'll go and read from the journal. So the very first quote in the Seven Steps to Awakening, again, this is from the Supreme Yoga. It's quote number 629, and it says, spreading the net of worldly objects of pleasure, it is this egotism that traps the living beings. Indeed, all the terrible calamities in this world are born of egotism. Egotism eclipses self-control, destroys virtue, and dissipates equanimity. The first thing that comes to my mind when I read this is the Tao Te Ching. And the reason is the first sentence talks about the net of worldly objects of pleasure traps living beings. And then the second sentence talks about the calamities in this world born of egotism. So it's kind of like on the one hand, we have the things in the world that we seek, the things in the world that we enjoy, the things in the world or the circumstances in the world that we consider favorable. And then on the other hand, we have these things that we would consider terrible calamities, like war, abuse, earthquakes, tornadoes. And if you look at it, it's kind of like there's a swinging pendulum from what we would call good to what we would call bad, back and forth. So on one side, we have abundance. On the other side, we have poverty. On one side, we have health. On the other side, we have sickness. And it just kind of swings back and forth. And when I read the Tao Te Ching, what I see in the Tao Te Ching is that we are being taught that if we seek what we perceive as good, that's kind of like pushing that pendulum. And we may even get what we seek. And when we do get it, we kind of let go of the pendulum and step back to hold on to what we think we've gained. And that pendulum swings all the way back in the opposite direction to the equal degree. And that, of course, is where the calamity comes from. And Yoga Vasistha seems to be saying something very similar. He says, spreading the net of worldly objects of pleasure, it is this egotism that traps living beings. So again, we're trapped by looking for those things that we judge as good. Indeed, all the terrible calamities in the world are born of egotism. There, the pendulum now has swung back into the opposite direction. Because we judge good, you could say, we also have bad. That's the pendulum. Ego eclipses self-control, destroys virtue, and dissipates equanimity. One thing that's particularly interesting to me is this comment, it destroys virtue. Because one of the things that we might think that we're grasping for is virtue. You know, we might, depending on how our mind is set when we say this, because there is more than one way to look at it, but when we go out to do good, to be a do-gooder, you know, we could have this idea that we want to improve the world and we want to make the world a better place. And in that way, we're actually pushing the pendulum. And again, that pendulum will swing back to an equal and opposite degree. So even our grasping for goodness and virtue creates duality. So let me read this quote again, and then we'll go see what I wrote in the journal. When I wrote in the journal, it would have been more... excuse me. It would have been more than a couple of years ago. Hold on, I'm just a bit dry. I have a nice big drink from Sonic here, so it will take care of that dryness. When I wrote in the journal, it would have been more than a couple of years ago. And in that time, I would not have yet have spent a significant amount of time contemplating the Tao Te Ching. So I feel pretty certain that we won't see mention of the Tao Te Ching in my journal entry. But we'll go and see what is there after I read this quote one more time. So here's the quote. Spreading the net of worldly objects of pleasure. It is this egotism that traps the living beings. Indeed, all the terrible calamities in this world are born of egotism. Egotism eclipses self-control, destroys virtue, and dissipates equanimity. All right, so I'm going now to 629A in the journal, and here is what I wrote. Ego does not let the mind focus fully on the suffering of the human condition. Ego sees good and beauty in this human world. However, good and beauty attracts attachment. And attachment to the world always leads to suffering. So the pendulum is there, even though not as directly stated, because as I mentioned, I had not yet studied the Tao Te Ching. But the awareness that attachment to the good side also leads to the what we would call bad side. The attachment to good and beauty leads to suffering. That is here. So the pendulum is here, even though the Tao Te Ching had not yet been contemplated. The first sentence is kind of interesting, though. The first sentence says, ego does not let the mind focus fully on the suffering of the human condition. I contemplated that a bit this week. When the Jordanian pilot was burned alive by ISIS, and I had a broken heart about that, and I went into that brokenness. When I was in the brokenness, at first my mind was telling me a lie. And the lie was that a line had just been crossed, that somehow the world had just gone to a new level of cruelty. And I even said something out loud like that to Danielle. I said the sentence out loud, you know, to try and, I suppose, explain to her why I was crying. She doesn't typically see me crying in the way that I was that day. And as soon as I said it out loud, that's when I noticed that it was a lie. In fact, the thought that immediately came as soon as I said it out loud was that, let's see, I can't even bring the thought up now. The Joan of Arc, here we go. Joan of Arc was burnt at the stake, you know, many hundreds of years ago. You know, this is not a new line. Joan of Arc was burnt at the stake. And when that thought occurred, there wasn't really any more thinking after that. After that, that's when I really went into the sadness and allowed the sadness, went into the broken heart and allowed the broken heart. But there was a realization that even with this sadness I was feeling, you know, because of the burning alive of the Jordanian pilot, that I was only aware of a tiny, tiny, tiny piece of the cruelty that happens in this world now and has always happened in this world. And I knew that my mind could never grasp the totality of the cruelty. But I also knew that the only way to respond to anything, but in this day I was contemplating cruelty, so I'll say the only way to respond to cruelty is with absolute love. Absolute love. And in fact, Some of you may know if you've heard me tell this story or if you saw me write it in Facebook, that when I came through the other side of that sadness, that's what I experienced, was a non-specific, absolute love that could not even comprehend a justification for not love. No such justification exists. So this first sentence of 629A, ego does not let the mind focus fully on the suffering of the human condition. Ego sees good and beauty in this human world. However, good and beauty attracts attachment, and attachment to the world always leads to suffering. I know that what this is really saying is, you know, ego tries to keep us looking at the good things as much as possible, so that we don't change, so that we don't transform, so that we don't see how harmful the ego is. You know, my little bitty judgments, you know, my little bitty judgments that the neighbor lets too many weeds grow in his yard, or, you know, this teacher is not giving my child enough help, or whatever little bitty judgments gets made in one's life. The ego doesn't want us to see how harmful those little bitty judgments are. The ego doesn't want us to see that those little bitty judgments are what lead up to these explosions that appear as cruelty in the world. For example, and one way to keep us from seeing that is just to keep us from looking directly at the cruelty. Can you imagine for a moment? Oh my God, this is a horrible thing, but let's go there anyway. Can you imagine for a moment if the instant I just judged my neighbor, I'm even going to call it a gentle judgment because that's how the ego would see it. If I judged my neighbor gently for not pulling the weeds in his yard, if in that instant I witnessed a gang of people come and grab my neighbor, put him in a cage and burn him alive, and the next time I turned around and I judged a teacher for not helping my daughter enough, in that instant a huge tornado came and blew away the entire school, killing everyone in it, it probably wouldn't take long for me to start seeing the connection between my judgment and the calamities in the world. It wouldn't take long for me to realize just how harmful judgment is, and I would drop it. But of course, if we drop judgment, we drop ego, because ego is judgment. And so we're not allowed to see that connection. We're not allowed to look at that. Again, ego does not let the mind focus fully on the suffering of the human condition. We may see a little bit of the starvation, a little bit of the war on TV, but we never really see fully how much suffering there is. And we definitely don't see the connection between our own ego and that suffering. Ego does not let the mind focus fully on the suffering of the human condition. Ego sees good and beauty in this human world. However, good and beauty attracts attachment, and attachment to the world always leads to suffering. So, there's another meaning in this particular little journal entry as well. I'm going to call it at the personal level, at the me level, because just now I was talking about the universal level. So for a moment, I'm going to tune in to the me level. At the me level, you know, I can, you know, maybe think of a bunch of things in life that I want, and I can even set out and I can have those things. I can have the money and the good relationships and the travel and the nice clothes and whatever else I think I want. And there may seem to be happiness because I have everything I want. Of course, if one looks carefully, you'll see that isn't happiness. That's never happiness. But for a moment, let's not look that carefully at that. At some point, something has to shift and change. That happiness can't be permanent. The partner that I have may get cancer or may have an affair or may leave me. The stock market may crash and I may have a minuscule amount of money compared to what I had before. I may get cancer or be in a car accident and be severely injured. So believing that the world can make me happy on a personal level is a lie, because again, that same pendulum that swings universally is going to swing personally too. And at some point, the great life that I appear to have is going to be lost and suffering will happen. So again, ego does not let the mind focus fully on the suffering of the human condition. Ego sees good and beauty in this human world. However, good and beauty attracts attachment. And attachment to the world always leads to suffering. I'm going to scroll down and click on 629B. And I'm going to read the quote again by Yoga Vasistha. This quote is the same quote for 629B. Spreading the net of worldly objects of pleasure. It is this egotism that traps the living beings. Indeed, all the terrible calamities in this world are born of egotism. Egotism eclipses self-control, destroys virtue, and dissipates equanimity. All right, I'm going to look at 629B. What I want can be seen in the world. One can work for what I want. One can strive and grasp, manipulate and control, lie and cheat, achieve and lose, all because one can see what I want in the world. What I want reinforces ego. So there's just no doubt about that. There's just no doubt that what I want and going about in any way trying to secure what I want reinforces ego, because it's reinforcing that I that is the ego. It teaches me that I am that. The ego, or the personality, of course, is not the truth of what we are. The personality is like a character that's part of the world script. And that character, just like if you were writing a character for a novel or a character for a movie, that character has an individuality which is made up of values, opinions, desires, fears. But you see, those values, opinions, desires, and fears aren't yours. They're the characters. They belong to the mask, the costume, not you. And so when I believe that I am the character enough that I try to secure her desires in order to make me happy, I'm completely confused about who I am. Some of you may remember that when I heard the teachings of Inner Ramana coming, the very last message that came was about three states of mind: the resistor, the doubter, and abiding. And the resistor was the one that was furthest from truth. The resistor was the one that was fully resisting the true self. Fully resisting the true self means fully occupied with the character as me. So when I say, here's what I want out of life, 1, 2, 3, 4, and I set out to get it, or I complain because I don't have it, or however that affects me, there's sure there's a myriad of other ways it can affect me, but when I fully believe that I am the character and these are my values, my opinions, my desires, my fears, and I live that, that's when I'm the resistor, the furthest from truth, fully resisting my true self. The second stage that Inner Ramana talked about was the doubter. And the doubter was actually moving towards truth. The doubter was beginning to listen to truth, truth teachings, and feel an inner confirmation about these truth teachings. And as a result, the doubter is beginning to question what has not been questioned before. So the doubter is beginning to question whether these are indeed my values, whether these are indeed my opinions, whether these are indeed my desires, whether these are indeed my fears. In fact, ultimately what the doubter questions is, who am I? You know, am I this person I've always thought I am? So again, the journal entry says, what I want can be seen in the world. One can work for what I want. One can strive and grasp, manipulate and control, lie and cheat, achieve and lose, all because one can see what I want in the world. What I want reinforces ego. And again, believing that I'm the character, believing that the character's wants are my wants, is the resistor state of mind. It's the furthest from truth. Truth being, of course, abiding as our true self. That was the third state. It was the resistor, the doubter, and then abiding. Abiding is the same as self-realization. So it's helpful, of course, to be that doubter and to begin to question what appears to be my wants, what appears to be my aversions as well, the things I don't want, what appears to be my opinions, my values. It's helpful to be that doubter and question all of those things. That is progressive, moving towards freedom. Just to believe them is to reinforce the ego, to reinforce the belief that I am the false self or the imposter self. So I'm going to scroll down and click on 630. The 630 in the Seven Steps to Awakening says, it is this mind alone which is the cause of all objects of the world. The three worlds exist because of mind stuff. When the mind vanishes, the worlds vanish too. Now, I don't know what he means by the three worlds. And sometimes when I'm studying Hindu masters, I will run across some things like that, and I don't know what they mean. And I very seldom go look them up because I assume I don't need to know. You know, just like I wouldn't need to learn Christianity in order to undo Christianity, I don't need to learn Hinduism in order to undo Hinduism. So I don't know what the three worlds are, and I'm not concerned about what the three worlds are. I do know what this apparent world is, and which is that understanding I can still look at the quote. And I can understand the quote. Oh my gosh, Kathy Smith. Kathy Smith is pointing out that resistor, doubter, abiding is RDA. I never noticed that before. Resistor, doubter, abiding. How interesting is that? Thanks for pointing that out. Yeah, I never noticed that before. All right, so 630 again says, it is this mind alone which is the cause of all objects in the world. The three worlds exist because of mind stuff. When the mind vanishes, the world vanishes too. And again, I can look at that. I don't have to get caught up in the three worlds. Just I could say this world exists because of mind stuff. When the mind vanishes, this world vanishes too. So, so let's go ahead and look at the journal. I don't feel like anything is coming up in me to say about that right now. So let's go directly to the journal. When I look at the journal number 630, it says, mind is synonymous with world. To see them as separate is to be deceived by mental perception. One thing that I noticed in 2012, this year that I spent, you know, really spending almost all day with Seven Steps to Awakening, looking at my mind, one thing that I noticed, and I'm sure it's in the journal somewhere, is I noticed that the mind and the world have an awful lot in common. You know, they really are, at the very least, a mirror image of each other. For example, the mind is just always shifting and changing. And the world is always shifting and changing. The mind is full of contradictions and conflict. The world is full of contradictions and conflict. You know, the mind can have some important issue of the day, some important problem of the day or the week that I'm just really fully focused on. And the world seems to have these important issues of the time, of the day, of the week, right? I just began to notice that they had so much in common. One thing that I've given up, or at least I'm trying to give up, I suppose where I haven't given it up yet will become apparent so that I can see it and give it up there too. But one thing that I'm trying to give up is belief. I think when many of us start studying spiritual materials, you know, our old beliefs get kind of shaken up and we start letting go of our old beliefs. But then we, without noticing it, we take on new beliefs. You know, so if we read in a book that we trust, like A Course in Miracles, or we hear from a teacher that we trust, that the mind makes up the world, we start to believe that. And what I've come to see is that that's nothing. Belief is nothing. I need to know this. I need to see this for myself. So I try not to adopt beliefs. I try to look. I try to ask, is this true? And again, one thing that I have noticed in this looking and this asking is that at the very, 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 very least, the mind and the world are mirror images of each other because they share so many characteristics. They are just alike. They are just alike. You've heard the term, it's a mad, 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 mad world. Well, you know also that it's a mad, 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 mad mind. They're twins. They're twins. And I suppose that was enough to let me begin to take the next step, which would be not believing the mind. Not believing the mind. And then through the process of not believing the mind, you start noticing things that begin to shift and change in your own personal life, because those things were held up by your believing the mind. And so when you start to disbelieve the mind, you start getting evidence that there is a connection between mind and world. So you don't have to believe there's a connection. You can kind of question it and see it for yourself. Again, number 630 says, it is this mind alone which is the cause of all objects in the world. The three worlds exist because of the mind stuff. When the mind vanishes, the worlds vanish too. And 630 in the journal says, mind is synonymous with world. To see them as separate is to be deceived by mental perception. So there's a connection there, but I don't ask anyone to believe me. Look for yourself. Take your own contemplation time. Do your own looking and see if you can see how they're the same. How their characteristics mirror each other. And then start letting go of mind. Probably certain aspects of mind will arise immediately to be let go of. And when you let go of those aspects of mind, see if the worldview, at least in your personal realm, doesn't seem to change in some way. And you'll then know there is a connection. I don't think it's a connection we can ever fully understand. There's not a, well, maybe. I mean, you know, I'm looking at people like Stephen Hawking and the theory of everything. Maybe somebody that can do math to that degree can at some point understand the connection, but not I. I could never fully understand the connection between mind and matter. But I can say I've had enough evidence for myself that I continue on a faith that is not a blind faith. The faith based on experience that there is a connection between mind and matter. All right, so let's scroll down and click on 631A. And I'm going to read 631 in the book, The Seven Steps to Awakening. One's own mind has become one's worst enemy. Egotism is the foremost cause for evil. That reminds me of two things. One, what I was saying with the first quote was 629 about the pendulum, you know, that, you know, we may reach for absolute goodness in the world. And by that, I'm not referring to the natural goodness that comes from awakening, but by really trying to fix everything and just be the do-gooder. And we may reach for absolute goodness in the world, and we may even get awards and honors, you know, for the volunteerism and the things that we achieve. But at some point, that high, high pendulum that we have pushed way up there through our do-gooding swings all the way back to the opposite and equal degree. As long as I believe I'm that false self, that's the case. As long as I'm acting from the belief that I'm the false self, that's the case. I remember in Jan Fraser's book, When Fear Falls Away, somewhere in the early part of that book, she comments how after her awakening, she saw that prior to her awakening, she did not realize just how, I don't remember what word she used, dangerous, maybe, just how dangerous or destructive the ego was, even in a kind, aware person like her. You know, I'm sure Jan Fraser was a very nice, character when she was the character, right? Even in a, and she was on a spiritual path, had been for 20 years, so she had some spiritual awareness. And she says she did not realize how dangerous it was, or whatever word she used there. Even in a kind and aware person like her. Well, what that means is she came to realize after she awoke and after she transcended the ego completely, that the ego itself is the foremost cause for evil. Even the ego in kind, nice people like us. You see, the ego is inherently selfish, even in a kind, nice person like us. I remember another person, and I don't remember her name, but she also had an awakening experience. I started reading her book, but she wasn't really a very good writer. And because the writing was not so well done, it couldn't hold my attention. But I did read the first few chapters before I gave up on it. And one of the things she said stuck with me. She said that she didn't realize prior to her awakening how selfish the ego is. And again, I'm sure she was a nice person too. And she didn't realize how selfish the ego was. She says, but after she awoke, she could see that the ego is just inherently selfish. And one example she gave was like when we're driving towards an intersection with a stoplight, we hope the light will stay green for us, for me, so that I can get to work on time or whatever. And when I'm hoping that the light will stay green for me, I'm not thinking at all about the other people who are going to get the red light. And I don't remember her name, Monica. I don't remember this woman's name. I only remember the story she told. Just the ego's point of view is selfish. You know, the ego sees things my way. One experience that happened, I mentioned to you guys again on the middle of this week when I was in that sadness because of the Jordanian pilot's death. Not really his death, but the means of his death. And I came out of that, and I told you when I came out the other side of that sadness, there was this love. In addition to this love, there was this ability to see points of view very easily. So like, and I had never been able to do this prior to this experience, but like I could just kind of look down at my heart and want to see Isis's point of view, and I could see it. And I could look down at my heart and want to see, you know, Jordan's point of view, and I could see it. I could see these point of views. And I could also see that when you hold on to a point of view, you can't see any other point of view. Which means a point of view itself is inherently selfish. A point of view itself is inherently selfish. So just to hold a point of view, just to have an opinion, is selfish. And I don't want to be misinterpreted as saying bad. I know people who still have this I am bad thought. As soon as they hear the word selfish, they equate selfish and bad, and they think, oh no, I'm bad. And no one's bad. No one's bad. You know, Isis is not bad. No one's bad. But we can be stuck in a point of view that where I can only see my point of view. It's not universal. It's not broad. It's very self-centered. Maybe self-centered is a good word. People don't associate self-centered with bad as much as they associate selfish with bad. But really, it's the same thing. So this energy that is the ego, being so self-centered, so selfish, naturally generates conflict, naturally generates war, naturally generates hating one another, naturally generates those who are better and those who are worse in one's point of view, you know? That's just what believing ego does. So egotism is the foremost cause for evil. It just is. And, you know, Michael Langford recommends in his book, The Most Direct Means to Eternal Bliss, he kind of recommends, you know, really looking at this very, very deeply. The suffering in the world. And also the realization that that suffering comes from ego. Because it's his theory that if you look at this very, very deeply, you will not want ego anymore. It will increase your desire for liberation, your intense desire for liberation. You just won't want anything to do with ego anymore. And that has really started to happen for me. I mean, I'm sure it's happened for me too, but you know how things can increase and then they seem new. That has really started happening for me. A few weeks ago, I remember telling some friends, I just do not want to tolerate myself in the wrong mind anymore. I had slipped into the wrong mind with some friends. And the suffering was so acute. The agitation was so acute. I just, no more. No more. When that wrong mind arises, I want to know to be still. Do not want to tolerate it anymore. And it's a blessed day when we really mean that. It's a blessed day when we don't want to believe our own point of views, our own opinions, the belief that I'm right, our own judgments, and we are just tired of it. I remember Bentinho talking about this too when he was here with us for satsang. He talked about how each time he could say kind of progressed to another stage of awakening, it was because he tired of something. So it's a blessed day when we grow tired of our own, what we perceived as our own self, our own opinions, our own values, all of that selfish ego-ness. Again, I'm reading quote 631. One's own mind has become one's worst enemy. Egotism is the foremost cause for evil. All right, let's go have a look at the journal. The journal, number 631A, says, mind says, I am you. Of course, it doesn't say that in words. If we heard mind say to us, I am you, we'd go, what? But without words, this message is always there. Whoops, did the mic drop? Are you able to hear me now? Yes, okay, good. All right, so I'm looking at 631A. And the first line says, mind says, I am you. And mind doesn't actually say, I am you. I mean, if we heard those words coming from our mind, speaking to something that was me, that was not mind, saying, I am you, we'd catch on. We would we'd catch on. Who says you're me? You know, we would catch on. So mind doesn't actually say in words, I am you. But that's inherently implied, right? That's inherently implied in every mental thought, that the mind is what I am and these thoughts are my thoughts. So mind says, I am you. Yet, listen to this. In spite of the fact that mind says, I am you, mind attacks you and buries you beneath a barrage of temptations called thought. Mind attacks you and buries you beneath a barrage of temptations called thought. So when I look at this, I kind of see two different yous. The first level that it's helpful to see this is when I am still the resistor moving into the doubter. One of the things that really helps you to start doubting that the mind is you is noticing just how disrespectful the mind is towards you, even you, the personality. How the mind is always telling you what a loser you are. How the mind is telling you how stupid you are. How the mind is telling you you're not as good as other people. If you start noticing how much the mind berates you, even you, the character, that might help you to start questioning, wait a minute, is this me? You know, what is this? Michael Singer, in his book, The Untethered Soul, you know, talks about if you could take this mind and the way it talks to you out of you and put it in another body, the body of a friend, on a sofa next to you, and if it talked to you the way your mind talks to you, he says, you'd kick the friend out of your house in 30 minutes. You wouldn't put up with it. And so we need to start noticing the mind, you know, how the mind just really attacks you all the time. And maybe say, wait a minute, is this really me? Or is the mind something different? Because it's constantly attacking even who I think I am, right? It's constantly telling me how stupid I am and what a loser I am. And I'm not as good as everyone else. And I don't keep the house clean enough. And I'm too fat and ugly. And, you know, gosh. Why do I listen? It's a good first level of questioning. But then there's a second level of questioning that's here too. It says, mind buries you beneath a barrage of temptations called thought. Well, what am I? What's this real I that could be buried? You know, not noticed when I'm caught up in thought. You know, once we start learning that the mind is not me, and again, that first level of noticing how much the mind attacks me is a good first level, because it starts to break that connection. It starts me to doubt that the mind is me. Then once I've doubted that the mind is me, I can start looking for, well then what am I? Who am I? And I can start wanting to look underneath that pile of thoughts and find the real me. I can start wanting to lose interest in thoughts so the pile isn't so thick, so it'll be easier to find me, what I really am, right? So mind says, I am you. Yet mind attacks you and buries you beneath a barrage of temptations called thought. I'm going to scroll down and click on 631B. 631B is still associated with the same Yoga Vasistha quote. One's own mind has become one's worst enemy. Egotism is the foremost cause for evil. And gosh, I'm wondering if you guys are in the journal, because there's something very, 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 very interesting in the journal. I've posted two excerpts from Revolver in the journal, because these excerpts came up for me as I contemplated this. 631B says, all suffering and every evil of every type is the product or effect of ego. I'll say that again. All suffering and every evil of every type is the product or effect of ego. Without ego, suffering and evil cannot appear. Ego is not in the world. The world is the product or effect of ego. Ego is thought. Corrective thought can be used to reverse the thinking that is ego, but this does not change the fact that ego itself is nothing but thought. When one is engaged in mind wandering and thinking, one is engaged in ego. This is the cause of all suffering and every evil ever perceived. Listen to that. Our mind wandering while we're brushing our teeth is the cause of all suffering and every ego ever perceived. And in fact, let me just play this one clip from Revolver where the two con men who represent the right mind are telling Jake Green, who is the one that they are pointing toward truth, they're telling Jake Green this exact thing. They call the ego Mr. Gold, but they're telling him that Mr. Gold, or the ego, is the cause of all suffering and every evil ever perceived. Let's listen in. They're playing golf on the roof of a building in Vegas right now.
What is the first rule of any game, Mr. Green?
The only way to get smarter is by playing a smarter opponent.
What's rule two of any game?
The more sophisticated the game, the more sophisticated the opponent.
Harmless the same, but where does it stop, Mr. Green? Where does this game stop?
It stops when you start to give me answers. Don't let them play head games with you, Jake.
Is it me that's playing head games with you, Mr. Green? You've heard their voice for so long, you believe it to be you. You believe it to be your best friend.
They should believe their opponent to be their best friend.
Where's the best place an opponent should hide?
The very last place you would ever look.
Do you know who Sam Gold is, Mr. Green?
The ego.
You should. Because he knows who you are.
The ego. Sam Gold.
Mr. Clandestine. Mr. Ambiguous.
Mr. Mystery.
He's all up here. Pretending to be you.
No one sees Gold. But Gold sees everything.
You're in a game, Jake. You're in the game. Everyone's in his game. And nobody knows it. And all of this, this is his world. He owns it. He controls it.
I've had enough of this shit starting to do my head. I've had enough.
He tells you what to do.
Look, that's enough.
And when to do it.
Tell him.
I said that's enough, Abby!
Eventually, when the opponent is challenged or questioned, means the victim's investment and thus his intelligence is questioned. No one can accept that. Not even to themselves.
He's behind all the pain there ever was. Behind every crime ever committed.
How can I be behind all the pain, all the crime? I don't even exist.
And right now, he's telling you that he doesn't even exist.
No one lives, and this pleases Gold.
No one but your two friends.
We just put you to war with the only enemy that ever existed. And you. You think he's your best friend.
And they will protect their best friend. With everything they've got.
You're protecting him, Mr. Green. But with what? Where's the best place an opponent should hide? In the very last place you'd ever look. He's hiding behind your pain, Jake. You're protecting him with your pain. Embrace the pain. You will win this game.
And it's interesting that the shift I had this week, I had when I embraced the broken heart. You see, if we're afraid to feel, The ego is never exposed. It's interesting also in that clip how they kept telling him, you think he's your best friend. And this Yoga Vasistha quote says, one's own mind has become one's worst enemy. You see, that's the truth about it. Egotism is the foremost cause for evil. That's the truth about it. All suffering and every evil of every type is the product or effect of ego. Without ego, suffering and evil cannot appear. Ego is not in the world. The world is the product or effect of ego. Ego is thought. Corrective thought can be used to reverse the thinking that is ego, but this does not change the fact that ego itself is nothing but thought. When one is engaged in mind wandering and thinking, one is engaged in ego. This is the cause of all suffering and every evil ever perceived. And if you haven't seen Revolver by the director Guy Ritchie, I recommend it. It has some violence in it, but it's a wonderful movie for understanding ego and also for understanding how we can choose not to listen to ego and therefore awake from the belief that we are the false self. And with that, my time is most definitely up, so I will let go of the mic. Bye-bye.